Chapter 7. Joan's Trial and Execution at Rouen. This chapter reports the extraordinary record of Joan's trial by an inquisitorial court composed of dozens of professional experts directed by the hostile presiding judge, Pierre Cauchon, see Part 2, Section 49. From January 9 until the end of May 1431, they tried to confuse and entrap this barely literate peasant girl, against whom they had not formulated a charge, a procedural flaw that would later make this trial easy to nullify. She stood them off until the very end, finally confused by her judge's decision that she had refused to submit to the church militant on the matter of wearing men's clothes. Joan had agreed to sign a document abjuring her voices, on the understanding that she would be transferred to an ecclesiastical prison in the custody of women, rather than remain in a military prison guarded by hostile English soldiers who threatened her virginity. Betrayed on this point by Cauchon, she resumed men's clothes, was thus declared a relapsed heretic, and was burned at the stake in the public marketplace at Rouen on May 30, 1431. Her ashes were scattered to the wind. She was 19 years old. It took 5 months to complete the proceedings that culminated in Joan's conviction. The proceedings from January 9 to May 30, 1431, can be separated into three phases. From January 9 through March 26, the procès d'office, or the judge's investigations before the official trial in court. From March 26 through May 24, the ordinary trial that culminated in Joan's recantation, or abjuration. And finally, on May 28 and May 29, the brief relapse trial. The tower in which Joan was held was still standing at the beginning of the 19th century. Several witnesses said that the crowned tower, one of seven that enclosed a vast lower court in the fortress of Bouvreuil, faced the fields. It is thought that Joan's cell was on the first story, looking toward the exterior of the fortress. Recent excavations have led scholars to modify their views of the layout, but one thing is certain. What is today called the Joan of Arc Tower represents the heavily restored remains of the ancient keep, not the site of her detention. Her cell and its neighboring wings probably rose above three indentations in the thickness of the wall foundation. One of them corresponds to the window, no doubt provided with bars. A second would have been the latrine, with which all towers of that type were equipped, and the third space must have communicated directly with the staircase. It probably gave access to some sort of tunnel that permitted anyone standing there to hear what was said in the prisoner's cell without being seen. Such surveillance, which also could have been exercised through the flooring that separated the cell from its counterpart on the story above, was the primary responsibility of a royal squire, John Gray, who was assisted by two other Englishmen, John Burwight and William Talbot. All three had been required to swear on the Bible that they would be vigilant and forbid any visitor who was not authorized in advance and in person by Pierre Cauchon, 249, or by Richard Beauchamp, 243, the Earl of Warwick, and the governor of the castle. They were assisted in their jobs by five Englishmen of the lowest rank, those who are called in French houspaillés, a word that in modern French has come to mean abusers. Joan was spared no humiliation. I saw her in the prison of the castle of Rouen, in quite a dark room, chained and with leg irons, declared Isambard de la Pierre, a Dominican of the convent of Saint-Jacques at Rouen, and an assessor at her trial. A certain Pierre Daron, lieutenant of the bailiff of Rouen, recalled that he saw her in a tower of the castle, with leg irons attached to a large piece of wood. She had several English guards. The most complete details were given by the usher Jean Massieu, 263, whose responsibilities included accompanying the prisoner from the place where she was detained to the place where the tribunal met. She was, he said, in the hands of five Englishmen, of whom three spent the night in her cell and two outside it at the door. And I know for certain that at night she slept with two pairs of irons on her legs, attached by a chain very tightly to another chain that was connected to the foot of her bed, itself anchored by a large piece of wood 5 or 6 feet long. The whole contraption was fastened by a key. Joan thus wore leg irons during the day, and at night her jailers attached to this fetter a chain that connected the foot of her bed to a piece of wood that she could not possibly have moved. Massieu testified, "Whenever I led her from her cell or back to it, she was always in leg irons." She could not, in fact, have walked in leg irons from her prison to the Hall of Judgment without assistance. From her first appearance before the tribunal, Joan complained of being held and chained and in these iron hobbles. Cochon had taken even stronger precautions. Fearing that Joan might escape, he had a certain Étienne Castille forge an iron cage in which she could have been kept standing upright, fastened by the neck, the hands, and the feet. The cage does not seem to have been used. Physical restraint, however, must have seemed inconsequential compared to the mental torture to which Joan had to submit. The mockery of the guards, the hostile shouts, the obscenities and insults whenever she appeared in the courtyard of the castle. How, in these conditions, could she have preserved her virginity and remained Joan the Maid? According to the principal notary of the trial, Guillaume Manchon, 262, the young girl feared that at night her guardians would do her some violence, and one or two times she complained to the Bishop of Beauvais, to the sub-inquisitor, and to Master Nicolas Loiseleur, 260, that one of the guards had wished to violate her. Someone seems to have intervened on her behalf. At Rouen, while several inquests were still underway in her home country, she had to undergo once more that examination of virginity to which she had already been subjected at Poitiers. This time it was conducted under the auspices of Anne of Burgundy, Duchess of Bedford. The examination took place before January 13, 1431, since the Duchess and her husband left Rouen on that date. The name of one of the matrons who examined her, Anne Bavon, is known. Joan's virginity was duly attested. Anne of Burgundy may well have forbidden Joan's guards to molest her. The ambiguity of Joan's situation was evident from her first days in the prison at Rouen. Pierre Cochon and the University of Paris intended to try her for heresy, so this had to be a church trial. According to normal canon law procedure, Joan should have been detained in an ecclesiastical prison, guarded by women, and thus she would have received moderately humane treatment. Yet throughout the trial, Joan was treated as a prisoner of war, chained and guarded by soldiers. To disguise this legal inconsistency, the Bishop of Beauvais and the Duke of Bedford, 2-9, had recourse to a legal fiction. The lock of the door of her prison cell was secured by three keys, of which one was to be kept by Cardinal Henry Beaufort, Bishop of Winchester, 2-8, who was to be present during the trial's entirety, and the two others were to be held by the judges, Cochon himself, or the promoter, prosecutor more or less, Jean d'Estivet, 252, and by the vice-inquisitor, who was to be designated by Jean Graveran, the inquisitor of France, 253. Since all three were clerics, the fiction could be maintained that she was entirely subject to ecclesiastical custody. This procedural trick had no more validity than the prohibition that Cochon tried to impose on Joan during her first appearance before the tribunal. "We forbid you to leave without our permission the prison cell that has been assigned you in the castle of Rouen, under the penalty of being convicted of the crime of heresy." But this did not fool the prisoner, who immediately replied, "I do not accept that prohibition. If I were to escape, no one would blame me for having either offended or violated my faith." Her drama and her life now turned on that ambiguity. Was she a prisoner of war or an alleged heretic? Joan reveals here, as elsewhere, that she considered herself an archetypal political prisoner, persecuted because she threatened and annoyed her captors and their ideology, and not a deliberate heretic. This accusation of heresy permitted her judges also to impugn the King of France. Since he owed Joan his crown, the legitimacy of his authority would be thoroughly tainted if she were found guilty. This conflation of ideology with politics and religion was already well established in Paris. Joan had not yet been born when the faculty of the University of Paris, in a densely argued dossier written by one of its members, Jean Petit, defended the political assassination of Louis of Orléans by his cousin John the Fearless. This was the first time since antiquity that intellectuals had extolled political assassination. What was the impact of this intellectual climate on Joan's trial? Philip of Burgundy, 2-3, was skillful at manipulating both ideological theory and the more turbulent sectors of public opinion. He knew how to gain the support of the university professors on one hand, and on the other, that of the high boucherie, the masters of the Paris Butchers Guild, who had at their disposal practically an army of cutlers and skinners, and who had already joined the Parisian revolt led by the eloquent skinner Simon Caboche in 1413. They controlled the city for 5 months, armed with the lethal blades that they, as butchers, had a right to own. Caboche and the Burgundian faction in Paris introduced a program of social reform, which finally made the wealthier bourgeoisie so nervous that they called in the troops of the Armagnac faction, who put an end to Simon Caboche and his revolt. Among the supporters of that revolt was an intellectual faction entrenched in the University of Paris. Caboche's quasi-revolutionary coup had seemed to them a convenient way to take power in the capital, and this was a key element in their grand scheme to win mastery of the entire kingdom, as eventually of the universal church. The Catholic Church was then deeply divided by the Great Schism, 1378 to 1415, see Prelude. To bind that rift, the Paris intellectuals strongly supported empowering the institution of the General Council, so that it would act as co-ruler of the church along with the papacy, in a situation loosely parallel to the way that the Kingdom of England was ruled by Parliament and the Crown. The English Parliament had assumed increasing power during the reigns of the last four Plantagenet kings, Edward I, 1272 to 1307, Edward II, 1307 to 1327, Edward III, 1327 to 1377, and Richard II, 1377 to 1399. The Lancastrian kings, Henry IV, 1400 to 1413, and Henry V, 1413 to 1422, were even more beholden to Parliament. The University of Paris intellectuals probably hoped to make the French National Assembly, the Estates General, as powerful as the English Parliament had become. If France became part of a dual monarchy reigned over by Henry VI, 2-2, a boy king likely to stay weak even after he had outgrown his regency, the French part of his kingdom might become a realm ruled by the Estates General, which the Paris intelligentsia thought it could control, since they saw the great councils, Constance, Basel, and their successors, as the dominant institution of their future church, this group of university professors must have dreamed of their eventual mastery over Western Christendom, as well as its largest and most populous constituent kingdom, France. The eventual success of their plans seemed inevitable to them. The Treaty of Troyes, which Cochon, the former rector of the University of Paris, had indefatigably negotiated, established a new polity founded on feudal conquests and justified by the clergy. But Joan of Arc, a peasant girl from nowhere, endangered this new progressive structure by her victories in war and her crucial insistence on the traditional sacramental anointing of Charles VII's coronation, 2-1. For the University of Paris, Joan's trial was also a chance to claim the prestige of the Universal Church, even before the General Council had achieved maturity. Although by now Pope Martin V was the sole pope, the Great Schism ended in Joan's youth in 1415, and although he upheld papal authority against supporters of conciliar supremacy, it was not yet clear that he could contain the challenge to papal power of the General Councils. Even before the great councils of Constance and Basel, the University of Paris had exercised decisive influence over the whole church by dominating the periodic councils called at the behest of the Avignon popes. By the adroit exploitation of highly visible heresy trials, might not the university regain the effective regency of Christendom that it had enjoyed in the days of the Avignon papacy? The leaders of the Council of Constance had profited greatly, at least in the short run, from their condemnation of Jan Hus as a heretic in 1415. To Cochon and others, that must have seemed a precedent for the case of this ignorant girl whose insolence would surely be easy to crush. The exemplary trial on which that faction counted began badly. The virginity test, which could have convicted the maid of falsehood, had turned to her advantage. The inquest into her habits and virtue that was undertaken in her homeland failed to produce compelling evidence against her. Having interrogated 12 or 15 witnesses at Domremy and in 5 or 6 neighboring parishes, Cochon's representative, Nicolas Bailly, had found nothing about Joan that he would not wish to find about his own sister. An exchange of information among the investigators confirmed this impression. Although the bailiff of Chaumont abused them as treacherous Armagnacs, the investigators brought back nothing that could be used as a heresy charge against Joan. As a consequence, the judges could find no grounds on which to formulate an accusation. In his punctilious analysis of the condemnation trial, the modern scholar Pierre Tissé argues that, through a striking procedural flaw, Joan was condemned only on the basis of the interrogation to which she was subjected at Rouen. Nothing was proven against her. It was on the basis of her words alone, as they were interpreted by her enemies, that she was condemned. Ironically, by preserving so carefully her words and the minutes of her trial, see 313, Cochon erected the most lasting monument to Joan of Arc. The difficulties that Cochon and Bedford faced were aggravated by the reticence of the vice-inquisitor, a Dominican friar of the convent of Rouen, Jean Lemaître, 259, who should have been the chief of the two judges required in a properly conducted inquisitorial trial. Lemaître had responded to Cochon's invitation by saying that, as much for the serenity of his conscience as for a more certain conduct of the trial, he did not wish to be involved in this present affair. He alleged that he did not have the authority, because his jurisdiction extended only over the cities of the dioceses of Rouen, and this trial had been launched on borrowed territory, borrowed from Rouen, that is, by the Bishop of Beauvais, on what had been declared his own jurisdiction by means of a legal fiction. Cochon insisted on preserving this element of inquisitorial judicial protocol, and he demanded that Jean Graveran, as inquisitor of France, require Lemaître's presence. It was only on February 22, after the preliminaries had been completed and the trial's second session was beginning, that Lemaître appeared. Despite the care Cochon took to respect the forms of an inquisitorial trial, it began with several irregularities. The inquisitor was absent. The preliminary information, prejudicial to Joan's religious conformity, was anonymous, from undisclosed sources, and no formal charges were brought against the prisoner. Tissé argues that it was an entirely exceptional phenomenon for this trial to have been based exclusively on the interrogation of the accused, without anyone, including the accused herself, knowing what charge was being brought against her. Although Cochon had assembled an imposing tribunal, he tended to preside alone, except on those occasions when he could get the inquisitor to join him. He wrote letter after official letter, and made a special appeal to the cathedral chapter of Rouen, which the King of England had informed of the change of venue in a commission of territory, permitting the Bishop of Beauvais to exercise jurisdiction at Rouen. In one letter, Cochon explicitly mentioned the demand of the University of Paris that he be appointed to conduct the trial. The terms of this last document underscore the trial's political nature. Our intention is to recover the aforesaid Joan and get her back under our control on one or another of the charges regarding our faith if it should happen that she should not be convicted or attainted with the charge of heresy. The first public session of the trial was held on Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent. On that Wednesday, February 21, 1431, about 8 o'clock in the morning, Joan found herself facing 44 imposing persons listed in that day's transcript. Among them were 9 doctors of theology, 4 doctors of canon law, 1 doctor of both laws, the civil and the canon, a holder of the degree of J.U.D., Juris Ultriusque Doctor from Bologna, 7 bachelors of theology, 11 licentiates in canon law, and 4 in civil law, as well as the promoter, Jean d'Estivet. Contrary to the traditional procedures of the Inquisition, Joan stood alone, without a lawyer to represent her. Her detention does not seem to have weakened her will or resistance, of which Cochon became aware from the first formality when she resisted the swearing of an oath. "I do not know about what you wish to interrogate me," she answered, "and perhaps you will ask me things that I will not tell you." This was followed by a new and more urgent exhortation by the bishop. "Swear to tell the truth concerning whatever will be asked you that has to do with the Catholic faith and with anything else that you know." "About my father and mother and everything that I have done since I took the road to come to France, I shall willingly swear, but never have I said or revealed anything about the revelations made to me by God except to Charles, my king. And even if you wish to cut my head off, I will not reveal them, because I know from my visions that I must keep them secret." This line of questioning persisted, and Joan continued to answer in this vein in successive encounters. Finally, Joan, on her knees with her two hands on the missal, swore to tell the truth about whatever would be asked her concerning matters of religious belief. Then the interrogation proper began. Every detained or accused person had to begin by stating name, forename, and social class. "In the country where I was born, I was called Jeannette, and in France, Jeanne, Joan. I was born in a village that is called Domremy-Greux. The main church is in Greux. My father is named Jacques d'Arc, and my mother, Isabelle." She then named her godfathers, godmothers, and the priest, Jean Minet, who had baptized her. Finally, she gave her age. "As best as I can tell, around 19 years." Another obstacle arose. The bishop instructed her to say the Paternoster, Our Father, to which Joan answered, "Hear me in confession, and I will say it to you willingly." Joan's wish that the bishop hear her confession, evidently not in conformity with the customs of an inquisitorial trial, was clever, in that it invoked Cochon in his priestly role, which required him to accord the sacrament of penance as much importance as did Joan. Despite the bishop's insistence, she refused to recite this basic Christian prayer unless he agreed to hear her confession. She then spoke about the fashion in which she was held in prison by 5 Englishmen of the lowest rank. She was instructed to appear the following day at the same hour. On the following day, she appeared for the second time. The previous day's exchange regarding the oath was reenacted. "I gave you that oath yesterday. It should be enough for you. You are burdening me too much." Joan consented, nevertheless, to tell the truth on any points touching the faith. Jean Beaupère, 247, one of the assessors, was put in charge of the interrogation. Like Cochon, he had been rector of the University of Paris in 1412 and 1413. He achieved the confirmation of the university's privileges from the Queen of England and the Duke of Gloucester in 1422. The university had sent him to Troyes to assist Cochon during the negotiations for the Treaty of 1420. Subsequently named a canon of Rouen, Beaupère continued to act as an English agent, and later was sent as the official ambassador of the King of England to the Council of Basel, where he arrived on May 28, 1431, just before Joan's execution. In 1435, King Henry VI awarded him an annual payment of £100 for his good services in France and at the Council of Basel. Beaupère collected benefices, becoming canon not only at Rouen, but also at Besançon, Sens, Paris, Beauvais, Laon, Autun, and Lisieux, despite the fact that he could not physically celebrate Mass. His right hand had been crippled during an encounter with brigands. Beaupère asked Joan questions about her youth, about what she called her voices, and about her activities between the time she left Vaucouleurs and her arrival at Chinon. He asked her hardly anything about her exploits at Orléans and Pathé, but concentrated on Saint-Denis, the skirmish before the city of Paris. "Was that not a feast day?" Joan answered, "I think it was a feast day." "Was that well done?" "Move on with your questioning." This line of interrogation swiftly reviewed her activities, concentrating only on the attack she led on September 8, 1429, the feast of the Nativity of the Virgin Mary, when Joan had tried to take the Saint-Honoré gate at Paris. After lengthy questioning, Joan was instructed to appear the next day, on Saturday, February 24. A surprise awaited her, for among the assessors was the priest Nicolas Loiseleur, who had more than once come to visit her in her prison cell, pretending that he was Joan's fellow countryman from the banks of the Meuse and her fellow prisoner. As a priest, he had offered to hear her confession. Once he won her confidence, he did so. It was revealed much later in the trial that Guillaume Manchon, one of the assigned notaries, along with his assistant, Bois Guillaume, 248, and other witnesses, Manchon added, was ordered to hide near the nook that opened onto Joan's cell in order to overhear what she was saying or confessing to the aforesaid Loiseleur. From the beginning of the interrogation, Joan grew increasingly restive and more stubborn in her refusal to swear oaths. Cochon, with several other assessors, eventually demanded that she swear another oath because Joan had answered in annoyance at one point, "Let me speak." The usher, Jean Massieu, reported later that in these interrogations, which generally lasted from 8 to 11 o'clock in the morning, it was standard for several judges to ask their questions all at once, so that many times she said to those who were interrogating her, "Fair sirs, ask me one after the other." In any case, when she finally said, "I am ready to swear to tell the truth concerning what I shall know about this trial," the minutes carry a significant addition, "but I shall not ever say everything that I know." Throughout her interrogation, Joan placed herself in a dangerous position by claiming to be in communication with the world beyond, to which she referred by the general designation of her voice or voices. She was clear about her sense of the supernatural character of her mission. When Beaupère asked if her voice had forbidden her to say anything about what would be asked of her, she reserved the right to answer later. Joan countered the question, "Did he forbid you to make his revelations known?" by asking, "If the voice forbade me to, what would you have me say about it?" She added, "Know for certain that these are not men who have forbidden it." She insisted on the distance between the world with which she claimed to communicate and that which surrounded her. "I have greater fear of failing my voices in saying something that displeases them than I have of answering you." Her tone, never that of an ecstatic or a mystic, is sometimes amused, even blustering. "This last night my voices told me many things for the advantage of my king, which I dearly wish my king knew at this moment, even if as a result I had to fast from wine until Easter, though it would be joyous to feast." Her bravado provoked a devious question. "Has your voice revealed that you will escape from prison?" To which she responded, "Do I have to tell you that?" Her speech was often eloquent. When she said, "If it were not for the grace of God, I would not know how to do anything," Joan provoked the interrogator to ask the famous question, "Do you know if you are in the grace of God?" Her answer, "If I am not, may God put me there, and if I am, may God keep me there, for I would be the most sorrowful woman in the world if I knew that I was not in the grace of God." The notary, Bois Guillaume, later declared, in the nullification trial of 1455 to 1456, that those who were interrogating her were stupefied. Joan's answer here echoes a prayer found in 3 15th-century manuscripts. Was Joan inspired by that prayer, or could her response, sublime in its simplicity, have influenced its composition? The latter is more likely, for the assessors would hardly have been so astonished if Joan had merely repeated a familiar formula. The notary asked that the questioning stop at that point. Stenographers had written the questions, along with Joan's answers, in French. Their record was later amplified and translated into Latin, 313. But from this point forward, Joan's replies were recorded in indirect discourse, rather than in the direct quotations recorded until her simple, sublime reply. For instance, she said that if she had been in sin, she thinks that the voice would not have come to her, and she wished that everyone could hear it as well as herself. Why was this change in record-keeping technique made? Some speculate that Cochon and his associates wanted two contradictory outcomes. They wanted to preserve the transcript, but they did not want Joan to seem so persuasive, and the force of her personality could be muted in indirect discourse. Their worried reaction to her replies is attested even more strikingly by the presence of several erasures in the French stenographic record. One such erasure occurs at this point, when Jones' replies began to be recorded in indirect discourse. Hereafter, we have converted the transcript's indirect discourse to the direct discourse that is reasonable to assume was actually spoken. Impressed as they seem to have been at Jones' reply, the tribunal remained hostile. Jean Beaupère moved to the question of the fairy tree at Domrémy. The inquest made at the village had probably revealed to him that most of her fellow villagers thought that Joan had received her mission at the fairy tree. Some of the witnesses at the inquest had said so, her own brother had assumed so, and she had needed to tell him to the contrary. Through this line of questioning, Joan evokes a village feast. Close to the village of Domrémy, there is a tree called the Tree of the Ladies. Others call it the Tree of the Fairies. Near it is a spring. I've heard it said that people sick with fever drink at that spring and go there to get water to regain their health. I've seen people do that myself, but I don't know if they get well or not. It's a big tree called a beech. From it comes the maypole that people say belongs to Monseigneur Pierre de Bourlemont, a knight. Sometimes I used to walk around there with the other girls, and from that tree I made garlands for the image of Our Lady of Domrémy. I've seen these garlands hung on the branches of the tree by young girls, and sometimes I did that along with the others. Sometimes we took them away with us afterward, and sometimes we left them there. I don't know if I danced around that tree after the age of reason. I might have danced with the children, but I sang more than I danced. She continued with a description of the Bois Chenu, the oak grove. You could see it from the door of my father's house, and it's only half a league away. She was not afraid to admit that she had been asked about prophecies claiming that from the neighborhood of that grove would come a maid who would do noble things. But, she said, I never believed it. This rich line of questioning terminates at this point. A new direction was set on the following Tuesday, February 27. On that day, Joan revealed the names of the saints from whom she said she received revelations, St. Catherine and St. Margaret. Jean Beaupère directed the interrogation on this topic as well. Having asked, apparently casually, if Joan were fasting during the current Lent, he resumed questioning about the voices. Had Joan heard that voice last Saturday?
I did not understand the voice very well, and I did not understand anything that I can repeat to you until I returned to my room, cell.
What did the voice tell you when you returned to your room?
It told me that I should answer you bravely.
Is it the voice of an angel? Beaupère persisted a little later. Joan then named the two saints who would return thereafter in her statements as specific members of the invisible entourage that she claimed for herself, St. Catherine and St. Margaret. Although there is lively contention about which saints with these names are the ones to whom Joan refers, it is probable that her St. Catherine was St. Catherine of Alexandria, a popular medieval saint who was patron of young girls, and also patron of the parish of Maxey-sur-Meuse, near Domrémy. Her St. Margaret was probably St. Margaret of Antioch, who was widely invoked on behalf of women in childbirth, and whose statue, which Joan probably saw, is still in the church at Domrémy. Insistent questioning was directed toward the apparitions of those two saints, to whom, on that same Tuesday, Joan added St. Michael. It was, she said, St. Michael who came first. She became insistent on that point. It was St. Michael whom I saw before my eyes, and he was not alone, but was well accompanied by angels of heaven. I saw them with the eyes of my body as well as I see you, and when they left me I wept and wished that they would have taken me with them. Also during that interrogation session, Joan mentioned for the first time the Book of Poitiers. If you have doubts about that, send to Poitiers, where I have already been examined. The Poitiers investigation must have dealt with Joan's apparitions, and there she may well have given testimony in which she named the saints from whom she claimed revelations. The interrogation followed that line of questioning up to the moment when Joan answered, I've told you enough about it. They are St. Catherine and St. Margaret, and believe me or not, as you wish. She then restated with force what she would maintain throughout the trial. I came into France only at God's command,
I would have preferred to have been torn apart by four horses than to have come into France without God's permission. Everything was done at the command of the Lord. I have never acted except at God's command. In medieval French, the term France referred to the core of the kingdom, not its periphery. In the course of that interrogation appeared a question to which Joan at first seems to have attached no importance. Is it God who commanded you to wear men's clothes? The clothes are a small matter, the least of all things, and I did not take up men's clothes on the advice of this world. I neither put on these clothes, nor did I do anything except by the commandment of God and his angels. Other questions about her mode of dress provoked only repetitions of these answers. She had done nothing that was not by the commandment of God. Probably not even Cochon could then have guessed the importance that her mode of dress would come to assume. The judges then tried to surprise her into telling about her revelations regarding the King of France. Was there an angel on the head of your king when you saw him for the first time?
By St. Mary, I don't know, and I certainly didn't see any.
She would later allude to a sign that the king received, permitting him to have faith in what she said. She made clear that the sign had come to her from the clerks. The question led her back to the encounter at Chinon and to the Poitiers investigation. Asked how she knew a sword could be found buried in the church of Sainte Catherine de Fierbois, Joan retold the startling story about that rusted sword with five crosses engraved on it. She knew from her voices that this sword was there, and she had never seen the man who went to find the aforesaid sword for her, and she wrote to the men of the church of that place that she hoped it would please them that she should have that sword, and they sent it to her. It was not very deeply buried underground, behind the altar. She did not know if it would be exactly before the altar or behind it. She said again that just after the sword was found, the men of that church gave it a good rubbing, and thereupon the rust fell off without effort. Had she had anyone bless it?
I never requested a benediction of any kind, and I would not know how to do that.
The judges dropped the subject of this marvelous sword, 3-6, and they passed swiftly to the description of the standard, which provoked another of Joan's famous responses. Would you prefer your standard or your sword?
I would prefer maybe 40 times my standard to my sword.
A little later, I carried my standard in my own hand when we went to the assault to avoid having to kill anyone. I have never killed anyone. The session closed with questions referring briefly to her military exploits at Orléans and at Jargeau. The tribunal convened again on Thursday and Saturday, March 1 and 3, for more public interrogation. The Thursday session may have been directed by Cochon himself. He opened with a confusing point that was a lively preoccupation for university professors, the Pope. A letter was read stating that John, the Count of Armagnac, 2-6, had written the maid on the question that had long divided Christendom. Who is the true Pope? As far as I know, I believe in the Lord Pope who is at Rome, Joan declared. This unambiguous answer might well have offended the men of the university, who had taken for so long the side of the Avignon pontiff, and who were still far from reconciled with the Pope at Rome, Martin V. They would soon raise an anti-pope against him at the Council of Basel, which would meet for the first time 2 months after Joan's death. Joan gave no more than a dilatory reply about her letter from the Count of Armagnac. Since this trial session concentrated heavily on her correspondence, Joan's first ultimatum to the English at Orléans was read. She acknowledged that text, with the exception of a few details. She provoked her judges. Before 7 years are over, the English will suffer more severe losses than they did at Orléans, and they will lose everything in France, and this will be accomplished through a great victory that God will send the French. In striving to establish precisely, which she refused to do, the day, the hour, and the year of that victory, the interrogators wanted to know what she had said to her English guard, John Gray, concerning the winter feast of St. Martin. Her guards filled their classic trial role, and their daily reports were used in preparing the interrogations. After a brief digression, the interview returned to the saints to whom Joan attributed her voices. She revealed nothing useful about their appearance and was amused when asked if the saints had hair. That's an important point, Cochon persisted. Did St. Margaret speak the language of the English? How should she speak English, since she is not of the English party? The transcript shows that Cochon repeatedly tried to confound Joan with questions about sorcery. Joan would be answering questions about the events at Reims, for example, when the interrogators would suddenly return to the fairy tree and the spring at Doremy. Or, what have you done with your mandrake? I don't have a mandrake, and I never had one. And since they insisted, I heard that it is something done to get money, but I don't believe it at all, adding, my voices have never said anything to me about that. Joan's voices had nothing to say about the judge's preoccupation with mandrakes, good luck rings, or popular magic formulae. Witness her robust humor in the interrogation session of March 1. What did St. Michael look like when he appeared to you? Was he naked? Do you think that God doesn't have the wherewithal to give him clothes? Did he have hair? Why would it have been cut off? Did he have a scale? I don't know anything about that. I have great joy when I see him. A frustrated Cochon returned from that exchange to the king's sign. I have told you that you would not drag that out of my mouth. Go ask him. The symbolism of the royal crown was raised. Almost taking the offensive, Joan specified that in addition to the crown the king had received at Reims, if he had waited, he would have had a crown 1,000 times richer. The questioning would return many times to that crown. The session on the following Saturday was longer, and touched on diverse subjects. First of all, on the saints who appeared to her. I have told you what I know, and will not answer anything else. Jean Beaupère, directing the interrogation that day, raised the question of the fate awaiting Joan. Did you know through a revelation that you would escape? That has nothing to do with your trial. Do you want me to speak against myself? Have your voices told you something about that? Yes, indeed, they have told me that I would be delivered, but I do not know the day or the hour, and they said that I should bravely maintain a good face. Did her idea of deliverance here refer to the spiritual deliverance of death and the afterlife? Or was Joan the warrior thinking of escape? It is least likely that Joan the prisoner imagined that she would be exonerated and liberated by her judges. Changing his tactics, Beaupère questioned her again about her male attire. I've answered you about that already, she added. It was written down at Poitiers, thus proving that the theologians who originally questioned her at Poitiers, and whose king found nothing but good in her, had raised the issue of Joan wearing men's clothes without finding it an offense. This point, first raised in early March, steadily assumes greater significance. Lacking any other solid charge, her judges eventually would rely on her cross-dressing as the visible basis for the accusation of heresy. The judges returned to questions of sorcery, asking about the pennons or badges adopted in the French army by the maid and her followers. Did anyone sprinkle them with holy water? Did anyone carry these cloths to an altar or a church in any kind of procession so as to make badges of them? More insidious were questions about the infant whom Joan had supposedly restored to life at Lagny, who lived long enough to be baptized, and questions concerning Catherine de La Rochelle, 237. In both cases, Joan responded with clear simplicity, as she did when asked about her jump from the tower at Beaurevoir. Her reply was memorable. I would prefer to surrender my soul to God than to be in the hands of the English. These sessions of public interrogation had now lasted 11 days. 8 days later, on Saturday, March 10, Pierre Cochon himself entered her cell, accompanied by 3 individuals who had already appeared several times among the assessors, Nicolas Midi, 265, Gérard Feuillet, and Master Jean de La Fontaine, 258. Who had from time to time been designated by Cochon to take his place during interrogation. The same role was played by the usher Jean Massieu, who accompanied Joan from her cell to the courtroom, and also by Jean Secard, a canon of Rouen, and an ecclesiastical lawyer who appears infrequently in the hearing reports. Nicolas Midi and Gérard Feuillet were among the 6 professors sent by the University of Paris as special envoys to follow the trial. They had been escorted to Rouen by Jean de Rinel, 267, an agent of the King of England and husband of Pierre Cochon's niece, Guillemette Bidault. Jean de La Fontaine, also a member of the university, a master of arts and licentiate in canon law, was not officially part of that delegation. Cochon must have recognized in him a conscientious man. He conducted his interrogations with rigor, but also with a certain reticence. According to the later testimony of the notary Guillaume Manchon, Jean warned Joan that if she did not declare her submission to the Pope and to the Council, she would put herself in great danger. When the bishop heard of that sympathetic admonition, he was strongly annoyed. Weighing the danger of Cochon's displeasure, Jean de La Fontaine left Rouen discreetly. He conducted no interrogation session thereafter, and disappears entirely from the transcript on March 28. During that first interrogation behind closed doors, Jean de La Fontaine began by questioning Joan about the circumstances of her capture and about the warnings that her voices might have given her at that point. "If I had known the hour that I was going to be taken, I would never have gone willingly. Nevertheless, I would have obeyed the command of my voices, whatever happened." And she recalled that it had always been said that she must be taken prisoner. She was asked for precise figures on the horses and money at her disposal. She also spoke again of the king's sign, a symbolic royal crown to which she would return several times. It was for her an image, almost a parable, that seemed to please her, and that became richer in her responses to questioning throughout March. On March 1, she had alluded to a crown 1,000 times richer than that which the king had received at his anointing. Her final thought on this point was summarized in Article 51 of the accusation drawn up by the promoter, Jean d'Estivet. "An angel gave the sign to her king. Joan had sworn to St. Catherine that she would say nothing about this sign. In bringing him the crown, the angel had promised the king that he would have the whole kingdom of France with the aid of God. As to the crown, it had been given to the Archbishop of Reims, who had received it in person and had handed it to the king in Joan's presence. The angel came by the commandment of God. He came before her king and made reverence, bowing before him. There were many other angels in his company, and also St. Catherine and St. Margaret, who were with the angel even in the chamber of her king. As for the crown, it was brought from God, and there is no goldsmith in the world who knows how to make one so beautiful and so rich." In reply to another question, Joan remarked that the crown will have a good odor, provided that it be well guarded. The majority of these details came out during the interrogation session of March 13, in the course of which Joan uttered another famous reply. When Jean de La Fontaine asked, "Why you rather than another?" she said, "It pleased God to do so through a simple maiden, to humble the king's enemies." Joan's symbolic language about the angel and the crown has disconcerted historians. These symbols, richer in meaning than mere abstract formulations, were standard instruments of exchange and communication, entirely in line with the spirit of the late age of medieval heraldry. Heraldry is a language of encoded signs and colors, the rules of which were not yet frozen. Joan herself provided a key to her symbolic narrative when she later declared that she saw her mission in this figure. The crown that the king received was her coming at God's command to establish him in his kingly power. At that time, symbolic memories were deep, preserved, for example, in the image of a clump of earth handed over to signify the sale of a field, with any written act serving only as a memorandum. But long before Joan's generation, this symbolic mentality was out of intellectual favor. The University of Paris, like universities today, preferred modes of logical thought expressed in the language of deduction, definition, and analysis. The record reveals when Joan was next questioned and by whom, but her interrogation now took place behind closed doors. It continued on Saturday, March 10, Monday the 12th in the morning and afternoon, Tuesday the 13th, Wednesday the 14th in the morning and afternoon, Thursday the 15th, and Saturday the 16th, also in the morning and afternoon. Jean de La Fontaine was the inquisitor. Various university professors, including Pierre Cochon himself, returned to get more precise information on several points on Saturday, March 24. The bishop returned on Palm Sunday, March 25, along with Jean Beaupère, Nicolas Midi, and two others whose names recur frequently in the transcript, Pierre Maurice and Thomas de Courcelles, 250. It is noted that they tried to convince Joan to stop wearing men's clothes, an issue that surfaces increasingly, under the pretext that she would not be permitted to hear Mass or receive the Eucharist on Easter if she persisted in wearing them. During the first part of the trial, which was now at an end, no regular accusation was found with which to charge her. None of the inquests Cochon had launched in January and February provided material useful for proceeding against her. Her interrogator's dilemma is revealed by their insistence on returning over and over again to the answers she had given during the preliminary interrogations of February 21 to March 24. But their doggedness did little but establish a clear sense of Joan's attitudes. On Monday, March 26, the ordinary trial began. Nothing in Anglo-American court procedure or terminology corresponds to this Roman law distinction between the preliminary trial of instruction and the subsequent ordinary trial, normally followed by judgment and sentencing. When Joan's answers to the preliminary interrogation are compared to those in the ordinary trial, her views on such matters as filial piety can be clarified, and both her earthly pragmatism and her closeness to the spirit world can be glimpsed. Jean de La Fontaine asked Joan about leaving her village, about her father, and about her mother. She replied, "Since it was God who commanded it, if I had 100 fathers and 100 mothers, or if I had been the daughter of a king, I would have left." She would insist when the interrogation returned to this point, which had first arisen on the afternoon of Monday, March 12, that she obeyed her father and her mother in everything, except in regard to the suit that she had in the city of Toul on the issue of marriage. It seems that Joan had rejected a betrothal arranged by her parents, and she had to defend herself in a breach of promise suit in the ecclesiastical court of her diocese at Toul. She claimed that she had not made any man any promise. Nothing is known about this trial at Toul except that Joan's cause succeeded. Her father frequently dreamed that his daughter Joan would go away with men at arms. He found this prospect terrifying. She explained herself in this fashion. "I heard from my mother that my father had said to my brothers, 'Truly, if I thought that what I fear for my daughter would come to happen, I wish that you would drown her, and if you do not do it, I will drown her myself.'" The interrogators then returned to her leap from the Tower of Beaurevoir. Joan explained it with her usual common sense. "I did not do it out of despair, but in the hope of saving my body and of going to assist many good men who were in need. And after the jump I went to confession and asked pardon of the Lord." "Was any penance imposed on you because of that?" "I bore part of the penance in the damage I did myself by falling." Elsewhere in the course of these repetitive interrogations, Joan mentions Franquet d'Arras, the mercenary captain she had handed over to justice at Lagny in April of the previous year, 1430. She experienced no qualms of conscience about his subsequent execution, for he was a rapist, a traitor, and a murderer. Her common sense emerges in her response to the questions about a certain hackney she was accused of stealing, but which she insisted she had bought from the Bishop of Senlis. "In any case, it was worthless as a mount," she declared. Of far greater importance to Joan's judges is the question of her otherworldly spirituality. During the interrogation of Tuesday morning, March 14, Joan had explained her relationship with her voices. "Saint Catherine told me that I would have help, and I do not know if this will be deliverance from prison or deliverance when I face judgment. Some upheaval may suddenly arise through which I can be delivered, but I think that it will be one or the other. But most often my voices tell me that I will be delivered by a great victory, and then my voices say, 'Take everything serenely, do not shrink from your martyrdom. From that you will come finally to the kingdom of paradise.' And my voices say that simply and absolutely, without fail. I call this a martyrdom because of the pain and hardship that I suffer in my imprisonment. I do not know if I will have to suffer worse, but I defer in this, as in everything, to our Lord." However hard she was pressed later on, Joan would never go further in her confidences about her voices than this declaration, in which she transcended her own desires to acknowledge the destiny that awaited her. She began to foresee her fate, despite herself, when she mentioned martyrdom. She wished to give the word another interpretation, but the caution her voices gave her brought her beyond herself. When she was asked if she was sure of being saved, she answered, "I believe firmly what my voices have told me, that is, that I shall be saved, as firmly as if I were already there." "After that revelation, do you believe yourself incapable of committing mortal sins?"
"I know nothing about that, but in everything I defer to God."
"That is a very weighty response."
"And I hold it also a great treasure."
The interrogation closed on that statement. It may well have influenced Jean de La Fontaine's decision to leave Rouen after trying to counsel Joan. During her imprisonment, Joan said she counted almost daily on the assistance of her voices, and indeed I had great need of it. Again, I would be dead were it not for the voice that comforts me every day. Her faith was unshakable. In the session of Wednesday, March 28, she reports without apparent embarrassment a prayer that also reflects this quality. The recorder and transcribers never converted it into indirect discourse or translated it into Latin. They simply left it in French, just as Joan said it.
"Very sweet God, in honor of your holy passion, I beg you, if you love me, that you reveal to me how I should answer these men of the church. I know well, regarding my clothes, the command that I received, but I do not know anything about the manner in which I should drop it. On that, may it please you to instruct me."
On March 12, toward the end of the morning session, Joan made this surprising confidence about angels.
"They often come unseen among Christian people. Often I have seen them among Christian people."
Little was made of this admission during the ordinary trial. Whatever skepticism her judges, mostly university intellectuals, may have had about such spirits, as a tribunal of the Inquisition, they could hardly accuse someone of heresy because of a belief in angels. However, Cochon was doubtless certain that he had ensnared Joan when the question of the church militant arose. On March 15, Jean de La Fontaine had opened the interrogation by asking, "If it should happen that you have done something against the faith, would you defer to the determination of our Holy Mother, the Church, to whom you should indeed defer in such matters?"
"Let my answers be seen and examined by clerics, and let them tell me afterward if there is anything that is against the Christian faith. If there is anything evil against the Christian faith that God has ordered, I would not wish to maintain it, and would be very upset to come out as opposed to the Church."
Either La Fontaine or one of the two members of the university, then present, Nicolas Midi and Gérard Feuilly, undertook to explain to the accused the difference between the church triumphant and the church militant. Put simply, the church militant was the Catholic Church on earth. The church triumphant was the church in heaven. The church suffering was those of its members in purgatory. Joan, who was not familiar with these abstract categories, answered simply, "I shall not answer you anything else for the present." Having now understood by her reluctance that this was a key question, the judges would return to it indefatigably. This question of Joan's submission to the church was raised more than 20 times thereafter. On March 17, Joan had an answer that should have removed any hesitation on the part of judges.
"It is my sense that it is all one, God's and the church's, and that there should be no difficulty about it. Why do you make difficulties about its being one and the same thing?"
When asked if she felt required to tell the whole truth to the Pope, she replied,
"Bring me before our Lord the Pope, and I shall answer him on everything that I should answer."
When the ordinary process began on March 26, Cochon knew that he finally had grounds for a valid accusation: inadequate submission to the church militant. By then, Jean de La Fontaine, as we have seen, had ceased to interrogate Joan. He was still present, however, on Tuesday, March 27, when, in the room next to the great hall of the castle of Rouen, a new public session took place, in the course of which Pierre Cochon made an appeal to the assessors for their advice on the brief drawn up by the promoter. The first of the assessors to express himself on this point was Nicolas de Vandoresse, 269, a canon of Rouen, licensed in canon law. He was punctual at the following sessions, in which he played an active role. It was necessary in his eyes for the accused to swear another oath. If she refused, she should be excommunicated. La Fontaine agreed with this advice. The majority of the other assessors demanded that Joan be read the articles drawn up by the promoter before being declared excommunicate. Some of them, such as the Benedictine Pierre Miget, prior of Longueville, 266, who eventually would vote that she be handed over to the secular arm of justice, declared that, regarding the articles to which Joan was unable to respond, one could not require that she answer yes or no, as was customary. The 70 articles of the brief from the verbose and sometimes vulgar pen of Jean d'Estivet were read to Joan on March 27 and 28. The brief expanded on most of the questions asked Joan, but was barely connected to the answers she had given during the hearings. Article 7, for example, says, "Joan often had the habit of carrying a mandrake in her bosom, hoping through this talisman to have a prosperous fortune in wealth and temporal things, affirming that a mandrake of that type had force and effect." The transcript contained Joan's energetic reply. That article about the mandrake she denied entirely. The same level of distortion appears in a subsequent article dealing with the young man who took Joan to court at Toul on a complaint of marriage refusal. In prosecuting that suit, she went frequently to Toul and exposed on that occasion, as it were, everything she had. The brief is marked by such twisting of evidence. In Article 13, Joan is reproached for having worn male attire, a short, reduced, and dissolute man's suit. Joan's categorical reply, which appears in the French minutes of the trial, was omitted from the Latin transcript. In the brief, men's clothes were accorded a place of increasing importance. The costume that Joan had considered entirely reasonable, as had the inhabitants of Vaucouleurs, her companions on the first journey, the king, even the bishops of the investigation of Poitiers, became a point of obsession for these judges. On March 15, they had gone as far as to try a form of blackmail. Since Holy Week was approaching, they offered Joan the chance to hear Mass if she agreed to put away men's clothes. She offered a counter-proposal. "Have a long dress touching the ground without a train made for me, and give it to me for going to Mass." Or then, "Give me a dress of the sort that a bourgeois girl would wear, a long skirt with something like a woman's hood, and I will take them to go to Mass in." This offer produced no result. Several of the articles fraudulently contradicted Joan's explicit declarations. For example, Article 56, Joan frequently bragged of having two counselors whom she called counselors of the fountain, who came to her after she was captured. The judges were also determined to associate Joan with Catherine de La Rochelle. That connection somehow led them to the conclusion that Joan would escape from prison with the aid of the devil if she were not well guarded. The transcript of her response to the brief does concede that to this article Joan responded that she would hold to what she had already said, and as for the counselors of the fountain, she did not know what that was. Again, always in the same line of thought, she was charged with having ordered melted wax to be poured on the heads of little children in order to practice divinations by this charm. Unperturbed, she denied these alleged acts of divination and returned to her previous answers. To the text of the brief, though it was fraudulent on many points, the responses Joan made on April 18 were later added. The last of these articles insisted on her submission to the church militant. So long as she, the church, does not command something impossible to do, and what I call impossible is that I revoke the deeds I have done and the words I have said in this trial concerning the visions and revelations that were given to me from God, for I will not revoke them for anything. What our Lord has made me do and has commanded and may yet command, I shall not fail to do for the sake of any man alive. And should the church wish that I do something against the commandment that was given me by God, I would not do it for anything. If the church militant tells you that your revelations are illusions or somehow diabolic, would you defer to the church? In that case, I would defer, as always, to God, whose command I have always obeyed, and I know well that what is contained in this trial comes through God's command, and what I have affirmed in this process that I have done by God's command. It would be impossible for me to do the contrary. And should the church militant command me to do otherwise, I would not defer to any man of the world, other than our Lord, whose good command I have always done.
Do you believe that you are subject to the church of God that is on earth? That is to say, to our Lord the Pope, to the cardinals, archbishops, bishops, and other prelates of the church?
Yes, so long as our Lord is first served.
Have you received the command from your voices not to submit to the church militant, which is on earth, nor to her judgment?
I shall not answer anything that comes into my head, but what I do answer is at the command of my voices. They do not command me not to obey the church, God being first served.
On March 31, Joan was interrogated once more behind closed doors in the hall where she was held prisoner. This interrogation bore more sharply than usual on obedience to the church. Joan must have spent that Easter day in prison without being able to hear Mass. New Year at that period began on April 1, on which Easter also fell that year. Thereafter, the acts of the trial are dated 1431. The following days, from April 2 to April 7, were devoted to drawing up 12 articles extracted from the 70 previous ones. According to inquisitorial procedure, these were to be sent to the doctors and prelates called in for consultation. It was necessary to submit both the charges and the resume of the hearings to doctors uninvolved in the process, so that they could pronounce the degree of the accused's guilt. The group included a certain number of assessors, among whom were delegates of the University of Paris, as well as two English prelates, William Hayton, 254, one of the two negotiators of the marriage of Henry V to Catherine of France in 1419, and Richard Pratty, who would later become Bishop of Chichester. Also present was Friar Isambard de la Pierre, a Dominican who had appeared frequently in the interrogation sessions behind closed doors since March 10. The next interrogation session took place on Wednesday, April 18, in Joan's cell. She was sick, and Cochon thought it appropriate to assure her that the doctors and masters would come to see her in a friendly and charitable manner to visit her in her illness, so as to console and to comfort her. Two of the doctors who visited that day testified later during the nullification trial. Jean Tiffen, the Duchess of Bedford's own physician, who served as an assessor in Joan's trial, recalled, "When Joan was ill, the judges ordered me to visit her, and I was brought to her by one named d'Estivet. In his presence, and that of Master Guillaume de la Chambre, 256, a master of medicine, and several others, I took her pulse in order to discern the cause of her illness, and I asked her what she felt and where she hurt. She told me that a carp had been sent her by the Bishop of Beauvais, that she had eaten some of it, and that she thought it caused her illness. Then Estivet reproached her, saying that what she said was false. He called her a slut, saying, 'It's you, slut, who ate a shad and other things that have made you sick.' She answered that that was not so, and they exchanged lots of insulting words. Afterward, wishing to learn more about Joan's illness, I heard it said by the men who were there that she had vomited a great deal." The carp to which Joan attributed her illness raises questions about whether she might have been accidentally or deliberately poisoned. Up to this point, there is no indication that Joan, whose constitution was exceptionally robust, had ever fallen ill, despite wounds, injuries, fatigue, and the often stressful conditions of her expeditions, campaigns, and imprisonment. Estivet's fury at her implication that she was poisoned seems excessive. Is it possible that Pierre Cochon had found a more expeditious way of terminating this disappointing trial? The other doctor summoned to examine Joan, Guillaume de la Chambre, testified in the nullification trial to the powerful English reaction. As to her illness, the Cardinal of England, 28, and the Earl of Warwick, 243, sent me to find out about it. I appeared before them, with Master Guillaume Desjardins, 214, a master in medicine, and other doctors, and the Earl of Warwick told us that Joan was sick, according to what had been reported to him, and that he had had us summoned to take care of her,
because more than anything in the world, the king did not wish her to die a natural death. The king considered her very precious, and had bought her dearly, and he did not wish her to die except at the hands of justice, and he wished that she should be burned. We did so much, visiting her with care, that she got well. I went to see her along with Master Guillaume Desjardins again, and the others. We palpated her on the right side and found her feverish, and thus we decided to bleed her. When the matter was reported to the Earl of Warwick, he said, "Be careful with the bleeding, because she is wily and might kill herself." She was bled, nevertheless, which relieved her immediately. Once she was so cured, a certain Master Jean d'Estivet arrived. He exchanged insulting words with Joan, and called her a whore and a slut. Joan was very irritated, so much so that she took fever again, and fell sick once more. Discordant voices were making themselves heard. Fortunately for Cochon, the University of Paris, which had been consulted on April 12, agreed entirely with his conclusions, and adopted all the articles drawn up by Estivet. A large group of the assessors, Zanon de Castillon, Bishop of Lisieux, Philibert de Monjeu, Bishop of Coutances, and Gilles de Durmort, Abbot of Fécamp, and his chaplain, Jean de Bouègue, all of whom appeared in the account books of the King of England, also approved this inquest without reservation. However, the abbots of Jumièges and Cormeilles, Nicolas Leroux and Guillaume Bonnel, demanded that the trial be conducted in the presence of the University of Paris, so that Joan might be better instructed, and that the articles be read to her in French, explaining clearly the danger that she incurred. 11 lawyers of the jurisdiction of Rouen also expressed reservations, and 3 of the assessors, Pierre Minier, Jean Pigache, and Richard du Grouchet, protested that Joan's revelations should not be interpreted in so negative a fashion. Yet another, Raoul Le Sauvage, thought that the question should be submitted to the Holy See. News sometimes traveled so slowly in medieval Europe that the people of Rouen were not yet aware that Pope Martin V had died on February 20. Worse news for their party was the accession on March 3 of Eugenius IV, who had been opposed for many years to the guiding spirits of the Council of Basel, especially to Thomas de Courcelles, 250, a political ally of many of the assessors at Joan's trial. Then there was the scarcely veiled hostility of the cathedral chapter of Rouen. After an early meeting on April 13, the canons had taken refuge in the pretext that they were not numerous enough to undertake valid deliberations. In modern terms, they claimed they lacked a quorum. On the following day, they reached agreement that the 12 articles should be read to Joan in French, and that she should be better informed on everything concerning submission to the church militant. It may be significant that neither this letter, nor the letter from the Bishop of Avranches, Jean de Saint-Avis, who formerly opposed the trial in its entirety, was preserved in the trial transcript. Several other clerics of Rouen, such as Jean Loyer and Master Nicolas de Houpeville, who was thrown in prison for his position, vehemently opposed the trial. Unanimity had not been achieved in the case of Joan the Maid. What was left in the way of a charge? First, Joan was charged with lack of submission to the church militant. But she had just been advised by Jean de La Fontaine and 2 religious, one of them Isambard de la Pierre, to modify her attitude on that subject. Second, Joan was charged with the wearing of men's clothes. But this seemed a thin basis for condemnation. Nevertheless, the wish of the English partisans was clear. Joan must be formally condemned in a way that would entail both dishonor and discredit for Charles VII. 2-1. Cochon would fail in his task if he did not find a way to comply with these instructions. The meeting of April 18 was devoted to what was called charitable warning in the vocabulary of the Inquisition. There also may have been hope that in her weakened state Joan could be led to make some compromising statement, but this did not occur. Joan thanked the bishop for what he had said, for her salvation, and added, "It seems to me, in view of the sickness that I have, that I am in great danger of death, and if such is God's pleasure for me, I ask to make confession and receive the sacrament of the Eucharist and be buried in consecrated ground." Taking advantage of her request, the bishop proceeded, Since you ask that the church give you the sacrament of the Eucharist, do you wish to submit yourself to the church militant? In that case, we promise to give you that sacrament.
Whatever happens, I will not do or say anything other than what I have said before. I am a good Christian and well baptized, and I shall die as a good Christian. As to God, I love him, I serve him, I am a good Christian, and I would wish to aid and support the church with all my power.
Do you want us to plan a fine and worthy procession to bring you back to good health if you are not in that state?
I hope that the church and Catholic people will pray for me.
Joan seems to have regained her strength when the second charitable warning was issued on Wednesday, May 2. In that session, Master Jean de Châtillon, a bachelor in theology at the University of Paris, and a friend of Cochon and Beaupère, led the interrogation. Regarding the church militant, Joan answered their questions unequivocally.
I believe fully in the church here below. I believe that the church militant cannot err or fail. But as far as what I have said and what I have done, I rely entirely on God, who has made me do what I have done.
And when they spoke to her of the Pope, she answered,
Bring me to him, and I will answer to him.
8 days later, Jean Massieu went once again to find Joan. He led her not into the Hall of Judgment, but into the great tower of the castle. Joan found herself face to face with Cochon and some assessors whom she had already seen several times. Jean de Châtillon, Guillaume Erard, 251, André Marguerite, Nicolas de Vendresse, the Englishman William Hayton, Nicolas Loiseleur, Aubert Morel, an advocate at the court of Rouen, and the Benedictine monk Jean Dacier, abbot of Saint-Corneille at Compiègne. There were also two men Joan did not know, Maugier Le Parmentier, the executioner, and his assistant. She was threatened with torture. Joan declared, Truly, if you pull my members apart and make the soul leave the body, I will not tell you anything else. And if I should tell you something, afterward I shall always say that you made me say it by force. They were clearly not ready for that response. Cochon decided to suspend the proceedings and get approval for this latest initiative from a larger group. On the following Saturday, he assembled in his house a dozen assessors, of whom only three declared that it seemed to them expedient to put Joan to the torture, so as to know the truth about her lies. They were Aubert Morel, Thomas de Courcelles, and Nicolas Loiseleur. It seems that Cochon finally perceived the wisdom of Raoul Roussel's suggestion, 268. The first of the assessors to be asked for advice, he declared that he was opposed to torture, so that a process as well conducted as this one not run the risk of calumny. The major local event of the following day is not mentioned in the official transcripts. Joan was not directly involved. On Sunday, May 13, Richard Beauchamp, Earl of Warwick, gave a banquet to which he invited many of the principal characters in Joan's story. His account book dedicates 2 pages to the purchases made for that feast, rather than the single page that was usually sufficient. At the end of that sumptuous repast, the guests decided to visit the place where Joan was being held prisoner. She saw, entering her cell, John of Luxembourg, 228, his brother Louis, 229, Bishop of Terouanne, Humphrey, Earl of Stafford, the intimates of the castle, and the Earl of Warwick himself, accompanied by a Burgundian knight whom she knew from a previous encounter, Aymon de Massy. The account book also expressly mentions, among the guests, Pierre Cochon, Bishop of Beauvais, and Jean de Mailly, Bishop of Noyon, 261. Those two judged it inopportune to visit the prisoner. In the nullification trial, Aymon de Massy reported the scene. John of Luxembourg addressed Joan, saying to her, Joan, I have come to pay a ransom for you, provided that you are willing to promise that you will never take up arms against us again. She answered, In God's name you are mocking me, for I know well that you have neither the power nor the will to do this. And she repeated that several times, because the Count persisted in saying so. And she said then, I know well that these English will have me dead, because they think after my death they will win the kingdom of France. But were there 100,000 Godons more than there are at present, they will not have the kingdom.
Godon was a current slang term for the English, who, to French ears, seemed constantly to repeat the expletive God damn.
At these words the Earl of Stafford was enraged, and pulled his dirk halfway out of its scabbard to strike her with it, but the Earl of Warwick prevented him. Aymon de Massy himself reports that he first saw Joan when she was in prison in the castle of Beaurevoir, and that he had conversed with her several times there. He admits, "I tried several times, playing with her, to touch her breasts, trying to place my hands on her chest, which Joan would not suffer, but pushed me away with all her strength. Joan was indeed an honest woman, as much in her words as in her deeds." Aymon saw her once again at the castle of Le Crotoy, and he reported that the chancellor of the church of Amiens, Nicolas de Queville, had come several times to celebrate mass in the prison, and he said much good of Joan. The Burgundian knight prolonged his stay at Rouen. He was present a little later, during the abjuration of Saint-Ouen. During the dinner of May 13, Warwick told the Bishop of Beauvais that the trial had gone on too long. Cochon received another important communication on the following day, when the rector of the University of Paris sent him a letter to announce that after numerous consultations and serious deliberations provoked by the visit of Jean Beaupère, Nicolas Midi, and Jacques de Touraine, who had communicated to them the 12 articles drawn up on the brief of Estivet, they had finally reached unanimous consensus that it was time to act so that the unjust and scandalous demoralization of the people, provoked by a woman by the name of Joan who was called the Maid, would cease. This statement was followed by commentary on the 12 articles, which clearly declared her an apostate, a liar, a schismatic, and a heretic. Pierre Cochon hastened on Saturday, May 19, to convoke the assessors once again in order to consider the conclusions of these venerable masters of the faculties of theology and canon law of our mother, the University of Paris. Once again, on the following Wednesday, Joan was given the formal admonition of the Inquisition and answered in her own fashion. I wish to maintain the manner in which I have always spoken and behaved in this trial. If I were already judged and saw the fire lit, and the bundles of sticks ready, and the executioners ready to light the fire, and even if I were within the fire, I would nevertheless not say anything other. I would maintain unto death what I have said in this trial. She made this response to Pierre Maurice, 264, a young master fresh out of school with a license in theology, one of the brightest lights of his generation, who reported it 27 years later. This rejoinder made an impression on him. He went to Joan's prison when she had just learned what death she was to die. When she cried out, "Master Pierre, where will I be this evening?" he responded, "Have you not good hope in God?" On Thursday, May 24, after the Feast of Pentecost, Cochon organized a spectacle designed to impress the prisoner. In the cemetery of the Abbey of Saint-Ouen, several platforms were set up, one for Joan, and the others for the assessors who were present under the presidency of Cardinal Henry Beaufort, Bishop of Winchester. Louis of Luxembourg, Jean de Mailly, Bishop of Noyon, and William Annick, Bishop of Norwich, private secretary and keeper of the Privy Seal to Henry V and Henry VI, were there as well, along with the abbots of Fécamp, Cormeil, Jumièges, Saint-Ouen, Le Bec-et-Loin, Mortemer, and Préaux. Guillaume Erard, canon of Rouen and a master of the University of Paris, whom the King of England would charge to represent the royal interests 4 years later at the negotiations of Arras, preached a solemn sermon at Joan. Several witnesses later interrogated in the nullification trial, in particular Friar Isambard and Martin Ladvenu, 257, another Dominican at the convent of Rouen, recollected certain passages. Ladvenu reported that the preacher had cried out, "O royal house of France, you have never known a monster until now. But now behold yourself dishonored in placing your trust in this woman, this magician, heretical and superstitious." At this, Joan interrupted him, crying out, "Do not speak of my king. He is a good Christian." Jean Massieu, the usher, who was at Joan's side on the same platform, and so was well situated to report the scene, reported that the preacher gave him a sign meaning, "Make her be silent." His sermon completed, Guillaume Erard addressed Joan directly. Look at my lords the judges, who many times have summoned you to submit all your words and deeds to our Holy Mother, the Church, explaining to you and remonstrating that in your words and deeds there were many things that, as it seemed to the clergy, were not good to say and to support.
I shall answer you. Regarding the matter of submission to the Church, I have answered you on that point. Of all the works that I have done, let a report be sent to Rome to our Holy Father, the Sovereign Pontiff, to whom, and to God first of all, I appeal. As to my words and deeds, I have done them on God's orders, and charge no one else with them, neither my king nor any other. If there is any fault, it is mine and no one else's.
To a further question, she persisted in replying, I appeal to God and to our Holy Father, the Pope. There are many instances of inquisitorial trials in which the appeal to the Pope was enough to interrupt the process, but that did not happen here. Three times Guillaume Erard repeated his exhortation, while Jean Massieu handed Joan a cedula, a slip of parchment designed to be attached to a legal document. Someone had written a letter of abjuration on this slip. Massieu urged her to sign it. At that moment, as Massieu reported a quarter century later, a great murmur arose among those who were present. At one point I heard Bishop Cochon say, You will have to pay for that. At that time I warned Joan of the peril that was threatening her, and I instructed her about signing this cedula, and I saw clearly that she did not understand this document. To Joan's appeal to the Pope, no other response was given than, It is impossible to go find our Lord the Pope at such a distance. Her request to have the cedula explained to her met with the same reaction. According to the testimony of Massieu, Joan demanded that the document be inspected by the clerks and that they should give her counsel. Guillaume Erard answered, Do it now. Presumably he meant for her to sign it. Otherwise you will end your days by fire. Aymon de Massy, who was present, asserted, however, that it was the secretary of the King of England, Lawrence Callot, often among Warwick's guests at the castle, who pulled from his sleeve a little cedula and handed it to Joan to sign. She first drew a circle. Lawrence Callot held her hand and made her draw a cross on the document. What was on that slip of parchment? The cedula was said to contain a promise that Joan would no longer wear men's clothes. According to the testimony of Guillaume Manchon, who in his capacity as notary should have been aware of the meaning of this scene, Joan laughed. We may ask if the cross that she had just drawn in place of a signature, we have seen that she signed her name on several letters from the end of 1429, might not have been a reference to the cross that she had sometimes put on military messages, as a previously agreed signal indicating that whoever received that letter should consider it null and void. All of this occurred in a strange confusion. The Bishop of Beauvais was reproached by the Englishman present for not having condemned Joan, while Jean Massieu read her the letter of abjuration. That letter, according to the later report of eyewitnesses, was 6 or 8 lines long, whereas in the trial transcript the cedula of abjuration consists of 47 printed lines in the French translation, 44 in the Latin text. As Jean Massieu declared in the nullification trial, It was given to me to read to her, and I read it to Joan, and I remember well that in that letter it was noted that in future she would neither carry arms nor wear men's clothes, nor would she cut her hair short, and many other things that I do not remember any more, and I know well that cedula contained about 8 lines and no more, and I know absolutely that it was not registered in the transcript of the trial, because what I read her was different from that which was inserted in the record, and that, the one he read her, is the one Joan signed. This scene surprised everybody. The English were indignant with the Bishop of Beauvais, the doctors, and the assessors of the trial, because Joan had not been convicted and condemned and handed over to execution. Their attitude was threatening. The king has spent his money very badly on you. Specific punishments meted out to reformed heretics seem to have varied, but the normal period of imprisonment was 3 years. If punished as a reformed heretic, Joan might well have expected to be freed eventually and to return to Domrémy. An eyewitness, Jean Favet, Master of Royal Appeals, said, I heard men say that after that sermon, when the Earl of Warwick complained to the bishop and to the doctors, saying that it would go badly for the king because Joan would escape them, One among them answered, "My lord, do not worry, we will catch her again." The conclusion of this episode is tellingly related by the notary Guillaume Manchot. As we were leaving the preaching at Saint-Ouen, after the abjuration of the maid, Loiseleur said to her, "Joan, you have spent the day well, and please God you have saved your soul." She asked, "Well, as to that, some of you men of the church arranged to take me into your prison so that I be no longer in the hands of these Englishmen." To which my lord of Beauvais answered, "Take her back to where you found her," which is why she was brought back to the castle she had left. Only those who had relapsed, that is, those who, having once abjured their errors, returned to them, could be condemned to death by a tribunal of the Inquisition and delivered for death to the secular arm. Despite his earlier loss of hope that he would find a proper charge, Cochon had succeeded only in making men's clothes the symbol of Joan's refusal to submit to the church. The cedula containing a promise no longer to wear men's clothes became the instrument of a game to make Joan relapse. What were the exact circumstances that constrained Joan to relapse? By the following Sunday, 3 days later, Joan once more wore male attire. She reclaimed male garments when she was returned to the secular prison and exposed to further abuse by her English guards. Martin Ladvenu affirms that someone approached her secretly at night. "I have heard from Joan's own mouth that an English lord entered her cell and tried to take her by force." Jean Massieu gives a slightly different version. Having returned to women's clothes on the Thursday after Pentecost, at the moment when she woke up in the morning of the following Sunday, Trinity Sunday, she could not find her women's clothes because the English guards had taken these away from her after throwing her a sack in which were exclusively men's clothes. And so she dressed herself in the men's clothes which they had thrown her. For whatever reason, Cochon learned on Sunday, May 27, that Joan had resumed wearing men's clothes. Wasting no time, he arrived the following morning at the prison, accompanied by the vice-inquisitor, Jean Lemaître, and several assessors. Joan was dressed in men's clothes, that is, a tunic, a cape, and a short robe, and other men's clothes, a costume that on our orders she had previously put aside, and had taken on women's clothes. And so we interrogated her, to learn when and for what reason she had once more assumed men's clothes. "I did it on my own will," Joan declared. "I took it again because it was more lawful and convenient than to have women's clothes, because I am with men. I began to wear them again because what was promised me was not observed, to wit, that I should go to Mass and receive the body of Christ and be freed from these irons. I would rather die than stay in these irons. But if it is permitted for me to go to Mass, and if I could be freed of these irons, and if I could be put in a decent prison, and if I could have a woman to help me," her expression, avoir femme, is written on the minutes, but not on the official transcript of the trial, "I would be good and do what the church wishes." "Since Thursday, have you heard the voices of St. Catherine and St. Margaret?" Cochon asked. "Yes." "What have they told you?" "God has expressed through St. Catherine and St. Margaret his great sorrow at the strong treason to which I consented in abjuring and making a revocation to save my life, and said that I was damning myself to save my life." In the margin, the recorder noted, "A deadly reply." After saying explicitly that her voices had told her what was to happen at the cemetery at Saint-Ouen that Thursday, she added, "I did not say or intend to deny my apparitions, that is, that they were St. Catherine and St. Margaret." "That being understood," adds the 1431 transcript, "we removed ourselves from her to proceed according to right and reason." Two witnesses later attested that on leaving this encounter, Cochon spoke cheerfully to several Englishmen, including Warwick himself, who waited in the court of the castle. "Farewell. Make good cheer. It is done." On Wednesday, May 30, early in the morning, two Dominicans, Martin Ladvenu, whom she had already seen sitting as an assessor in the trial, and his assistant, Jean Toumouillet, went to Joan's cell. In the transcript, Toumouillet has left us a moving report. The day that Joan was abandoned to secular judgment and delivered to be burned, I found myself in the morning in the prison with Friar Martin Ladvenu, whom the Bishop of Beauvais had sent to tell her of her coming death, and to induce her to true contrition and penance, and also to hear her confession, which Ladvenu did very carefully and charitably. And when he announced to the poor woman the death that she was to die that day, which her judges had ordered, and when she had understood and heard the hard and cruel death that was coming, she began to cry out sorrowfully and pitiably to tear and pull her hair. "Alas, that they treat me so horribly and cruelly that my body, clean and whole, which was never corrupted, should be today consumed and reduced to ashes. Ah, I would prefer to be beheaded 7 times than to be burned like that. Alas, if I had been in an ecclesiastical prison to which I submitted myself, and if I had been guarded by men of the church, not by my enemies and adversaries, it would not have turned out for me as miserably as it has. Ah, I protest before God, the great judge, the great wrongs and grievances that they have done me." She then made marvelous complaint in that place of the oppression and violences that had been done to her in prison by the jailers and by the others they had made enter against her. After these complaints, the bishop arrived, to whom she said immediately, "Bishop, I die because of you." He began to remonstrate with her, saying, "Ah, Joan, take it patiently. You will die because you have not held to what you promised us, and because you returned to your first witchcraft." And the poor maid answered him, "Alas, if you had put me in the prison of a church court and handed me over to the hands of competent and agreeable ecclesiastical caretakers, this would not have happened to me. That is why I complain of you before God." That being done, I went outside and heard no more. The usher, Jean Massieu, who had also been sent by the Bishop of Beauvais, told how Martin Ladvenu heard Joan's confession, after which she asked to receive the Eucharist. The Dominican was perplexed. Should he give communion to an excommunicate? He sent someone to ask the Bishop of Beauvais, who made this surprising response, "Let them give her the sacrament of the Eucharist and anything she asks." Massieu himself went to find a stole and a candle, so that the sacrament could be given her with dignity. Joan was then led to the old marketplace, where, as for the spectacle at the Saint-Ouen cemetery, several platforms had been set up, for she had to endure a final oration, this one delivered by Nicolas Midi. The investigation of her relapse had been managed with dispatch. Beecham, having established on Monday the 28th that Joan had resumed men's clothes, quickly convoked the assessors for the next day, May 29, to bring them up to date on this sign of insubordination to the church militant, and to deliberate what should be done. He was able to convene 42 assessors, to whom he posed the question of what to do with Joan, given the manner in which she had returned to her errors. In the course of this final session, 39 of the assessors declared that the cedula should be read to her anew and should be explained to her. Only 3 of the assessors were of the opinion that she should be abandoned to secular justice without further effort. Denis Gastinel, Nicolas de Vendresse, and a certain Jean Pinchon, who had been awarded posts as canon at the cathedrals of Paris and Rouen while still archdeacon at Jouy-en-Josas. This was perhaps an unexpected but merely formal obstacle, since the assessors had only a consultative voice, whereas Cochon was the judge, along with the vice-inquisitor Jean Lemaître, whose name does not appear in the records for this final session. Cochon moved ahead and made preparations for the resolution of this overlong trial. In haste, Cochon flouted the procedural rules of an inquisitorial trial. Laurent, the bailiff of Rouen, later recalled that in a similar case, a malefactor condemned by ecclesiastical justice had been brought to what he called the mob, that is, to the hall in which the bailiff heard cases, so that a regular secular sentence could be pronounced. Cochon did not obtain the sentence of a secular court. This was a serious irregularity. Cochon simply delivered Joan directly to be burned at the stake prepared in the old marketplace. The sentence was pronounced as though Joan had been abandoned to secular justice. Immediately after that sentence, she was put in the hands of the bailiff, and before the bailiff or I, to whom it belonged to pronounce such a sentence, had the chance to pronounce one, the executioner seized Joan without further ado and led her to the place where the wood had been prepared, and she was burned. All of this took place in the presence of a large number of armed men, 800, according to Jean Massieu, Monsieur was not always exact in his estimates, and this number may be exaggerated, but it is not improbably large, since, besides the regular garrison of the castle, a considerable number of men-at-arms must have been assembled for a planned attack on Louviers. Guédon captures an atmosphere of haste among a mass of soldiery supervising the scene and surrounding the scaffold, ready to contain the crowd. While Joan was making her devotions and pious lamentations, I was strongly pressed by the English, and indeed by one of their captains, to leave her in their hands, so as to make her die more quickly. They said to me, whose office was to comfort her on the scaffold, "Priest, are you going to let us get done in time for dinner?" And impatiently, without any former indication of judgment, they sent her to the fire, saying to the master of the work, "Do your job." And so she was brought and attached to the stake, continuing to praise God and the saints while lamenting devoutly. The last word she cried in a high voice as she died was, "Jesus!" This haste, this crush of the crowd, these hundreds of English men-at-arms, this executioner, his name was Geoffroy Terrage, all for one young girl who in a high voice lamented and invoked God. One gesture of sympathy is mentioned. With great devotion, Joan asked to have the cross, and hearing that, an Englishman who was present there made her a little one in wood from the end of a stick, which he handed her, and she took it devoutly and kissed it, making a pious lamentation to God, our Redeemer, who had suffered on the cross, of which cross she had the sign and representation, and she put that cross in her bosom, between her flesh and her garments. Hearing that request, Friar Isambard de la Pierre went to find in the nearby church of Saint-Laurent a cross to hold elevated right above her eyes up to the moment of death, so that the cross on which God hung during his life could be continually before her sight. And he attested that Joan, being already surrounded by the flame, never ceased up to the end to proclaim and to profess in a high voice the holy name of Jesus, imploring and invoking without cease the aid of the saints of paradise. And again, which is more, while surrendering her spirit and letting her head fall, she uttered the name of Jesus as a sign that she was fervent in the faith of God. These cries in the old marketplace, which she uttered in a high and strong voice, according to those who were there, above the crackling flame amid the noise of crowd, moved many who were present, including some of the English. Several witnesses in the retrial of 1456 remembered the tears of Louis of Luxembourg, Bishop of Thérouanne, who was entirely devoted to the English cause. The executioner, who had been called to torture her in the dungeon in Rouen, Maugier le Parmentier, said, "Once in the fire she cried out more than 6 times, 'Jesus!' And especially in her last breath she cried with a strong voice, 'Jesus!' so that everyone present could hear it. Almost all wept with pity." Isambard reported an event that marked Joan's fellowship with the martyrs according to the sensibility of medieval Christianity. One of the Englishmen, a soldier who detested her exceptionally and had sworn that with his own hand he would bring a bundle of sticks to Joan's stake, at the moment he did it and heard Joan crying the name of Jesus in her last moment, stood struck with stupor as though in an ecstasy, and had to be led to a tavern near the old marketplace, so that with the help of some drink he could regain his strength. And having had a meal with a friar of the order of friars preachers, this Englishman confessed, through the mouth of that friar, who was also English, that he had sinned gravely, and that he repented what he had done against Joan, whom he now took to be a holy woman, for, as it seemed to him, this Englishman had himself seen, at the moment that Joan gave up her spirit, a white dove emerge from her and take flight toward France. And the executioner, after lunch on that same day, came to a convent of friars preachers and told me, as well as Friar Martin Ladvenu, that he was damned because he had burned a holy woman. Pierre Cusquel, who had seen her several times because he did masonry work at the castle, had not been present because my heart could not have stood it and would have suffered from pity for Joan. But he recounted, "I have heard it said that Master Jean Tressart, secretary to the King of England, coming back from Joan's execution, lamentably afflicted and moaning over what he had seen in that place, said, 'We are all lost, for it is a good and holy person that was burned.' and that he thought that her soul was in the hands of God, and that when she was in the midst of the flames she had continuously called upon the name of the Lord Jesus. One of the assessors, Jean Alespie, 245, a canon of Rouen, who was one of the agents of the King of England when that city had surrendered to the English in 1419, wept abundantly, according to the witnesses, and said, "I wish that my soul were where I believe this woman's soul is." Warwick ordered her ashes to be collected and thrown into the Seine, so that no relics could be claimed later. Even so, rumors began to spread, as Jean Massieu, 263, tells us. "I heard it said by Jean Fleury, a clerk of the bailiff and the recorder, that the executioner told him that although her body had been burned in the fire and reduced to ashes, her heart remained intact and full of blood, and he was told to gather the ashes and everything that remained of her and to throw them in the Seine, which he did." According to Friar Isambard, the executioner affirmed that, "despite the oil, the sulphur, and the carbon that he had applied to the entrails and the heart of Joan, he still could not make them burn in any way, nor could he reduce her entrails and her heart to ashes, at which he was as astonished as if by a confirmed miracle."